Hello, and welcome to News on Overdrive on WHUS Stores. I'm Kate Ariano.
And I'm Jonathan Kapoyovich.
And we're here to steer you through the sometimes confusing and often overwhelming news around you.
Each week, Kate and I pick a different relevant topic to explore. We bring our original interviews and our hours of research right to you to give the facts that you need to know.
We've got a show full of some really informative interviews for you today, so please note that from this point forward, the views and opinions expressed on this WHUS News Department show are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily the views of the staff, management, or licensee of WHUS Radio or the University of Connecticut. This week, we'll be talking about all things COVID-19, what you need to know, how the virus has impacted our local community a year later. So, Jonathan, we're in phase 1B of COVID-19 vaccinations in Connecticut, which is great to see that things are getting on a roll. The people eligible right now are those who are 75 and older, while individuals between the ages of 65 and 74 are expected to start scheduling vaccines for the new phase 1C, which I'm not entirely sure when that one's coming up. Throughout phase 1B, though, individuals living in congregate settings will have the opportunity to receive the vaccine. And Connecticut's goal is to have residents get access to the vaccine by late spring or early summer, meaning all of Connecticut residents.
Well, Kate, aside from the phase 1C, right now we're in phase 1B, but the state is still planning further phases for vaccine distribution. People like us, from 16 to 64, college students, up to people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, with moderate or no risk health conditions, can expect to get their vaccines last, unfortunately. However, our Governor Lamont has praised the effective and good start of distribution in Connecticut, and places close to us, like CVS and Walgreens, have partnered with the government to make and continue to make vaccine distribution easier and more accessible to Connecticut residents. If we zoom down a little more locally to where we are, the University of Connecticut has started administering vaccines to its community health workers, as the state plan dictates for phases 1B.
It really is great to see how far Connecticut is coming along with this vaccine distribution. And of course, we know nothing is perfect, and we'll go into a bit of that later on during our show, but we do seem to be pretty up there when it comes to vaccine distribution throughout the country, I would say. And a unique thing that we're seeing about this vaccine is that you can't actually get COVID-19 from the vaccine, although some people who don't believe in the vaccine's efficacy think otherwise. I got the opportunity to speak with Dr. David Bannick from UConn Health's Infectious Diseases Department, and we talked for a while. He explained to me what exactly an mRNA vaccine is, because that's what the COVID-19 vaccine is. He told me about how it works, why there's no need to be afraid of it, and what the future looks like for mRNA vaccines, which is quite interesting. Take a listen.
So, good question. So, you know, most vaccines work by basically providing you either a killed version of a virus or like a small part of the virus. That's how like the flu vaccine works. You know, other vaccines like measles vaccines have like a live kind of what we call attenuated virus. But basically by administering the virus to the vaccine, your body makes an immune response, and that provides the antibodies and the immune cells that are needed to protect you in case you get exposed to that virus in the future. So the way that the mRNA vaccine works is rather than actually giving you virus or part of the virus, what it does is in the vaccine itself, it has the mRNA, which is like a little bit of genetic code that's given in the vaccine. The body kind of it recognizes it and codes for that protein that is part of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus that causes COVID-19. So it kind of takes advantage of the body's own coding in properties and machinery to be able to produce that protein. And then once you make that protein, you make that immune response, the immune cells, the antibodies that are what's needed to protect you if you were to get exposed to the virus in the future. So just a very little bit of genetic code that your body uses to make the protein that you respond to.
Got it. So instead of giving the body a part, you know, the dead part or a small part of the virus, it's giving the instructions of the virus.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. Specifically, it's instructions for just a small piece of the virus. So for this one protein in the virus. So you don't actually like synthesize virus or anything like that. You only synthesize that one protein, which is what generates the immune response to provide the protection.
Got it. Okay. So another thing that we're seeing is that the COVID-19 vaccine is done in two doses. So can you talk to me about that and about how immunity is not really instantaneous with this? It takes a couple of weeks.
So for most of our vaccines, you do need a little bit of time from getting the actual vaccine to your body to produce those cells, the antibodies that provide the immunity to the infection. You know, this particular vaccine is a two-dose vaccine. So you get your first dose and your body does start to make some of those cells and the antibodies that are protective. But in order to get a sufficient quantity of antibody and protective cells, that second dose is what's needed. And typically the optimal level of protection is usually a couple of weeks after the second dose.
Gotcha.
But you do start to get some protection even after that first dose.
Gotcha. So I want to go back to the mRNA vaccine really quickly. Do you think that since it is being used for the COVID-19 vaccine, is this something that's going to be more widely adopted for use in potential vaccines in the future?
You know, I do think it is. So the mRNA vaccines, you know, this technology has been in development for well over a decade. And, you know, there's interest in using this technology for treatments as well as for vaccines. A lot of the focus has been on cancer therapies. So using mRNA as a way to kind of help the immune system fight against cancers, even as a cancer vaccine approach. You know, this has been studied you know, probably pretty extensively, but this is the first kind of widespread use of a vaccine using mRNA technology against a virus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think from what we saw in the phase three clinical trials, both in terms of efficacy and safety, there's a lot of promise that this is a good technology. Plus, you know, the additional benefit, which I think is really important, is that it's very adaptable. So we can basically use what we know about the genetics of the different viruses and make vaccines pretty quickly, incorporating those that mRNA code for each of the different viruses. So right now, you know, we're using one that was developed for COVID-19. But there are other viruses out there that this technology has been explored, things like Zika virus, other sort of emerging viruses that are new and that we don't have existing vaccines against, and maybe even some of the ones that we do have vaccines against. So things like the flu virus, the flu vaccine could potentially incorporate this kind of technology in the future. So, you know, I do think its adaptability as well as the safety and efficacy that we're seeing from the COVID vaccine really brings this a lot of promise to this type of technology in the future.
So the last question I have for you before I kind of open it up to see if there's anything else you wanted to comment on is something that we're, you know, seeing with more information coming out about the vaccine is that there are still people who are pretty wary of getting the vaccine, you know, saying they're not going to, people who are afraid. So what kind of steps is UConn Health and other medical centers around Connecticut and the government of Connecticut taking to quell these fears and to show people the efficacy and the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine?
So I think there's a few different ways that we're doing that. So we are really focusing on our education and communication to both our UConn Health community, but also sort of outward facing communities that may be looking towards UConn Health and our medical expertise. Mm-hmm. So we've really been, primarily, our initial focus was on our own healthcare employees, ensuring that you know the data that was collected from the phase three clinical trial is shared with everyone. So to be sort of transparent as to the efficacy of the vaccine and the safety of the vaccine as well, particularly you know what we know and what we don't know about different subgroups within the population in terms of safety. So we've had a lot of educational effort here at UConn. Through several different venues to help, you know, provide that education and that communication to our community. You know, I think that the other important piece of this is the monitoring that's going on. So the safety monitoring. So, you know, here at UConn Health, we have a vaccine call center that is available both to help answer questions before people get their vaccine, but also any symptoms afterwards are reported to our call center. Additionally, the CDC has two other important monitoring systems for safety. So one of them is called VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And that's been in place for many years. It was initially primarily focused on pediatric vaccines, but now it's been it's sort of been adopted into the COVID vaccine safety monitoring. You know, that system is constantly collecting data on any adverse events that may or may not be related to the vaccine, but may but are sort of temporally associated with receiving a vaccine. Mm-hmm. The other safety monitoring system is called VSafe. That is a safety system that was specifically designed for the COVID-19 vaccine. This is what we call an active surveillance system. So when you get your vaccine, you sign up for VSafe, and what this this program does is it basically reaches out to you, your phone, your text messaging, periodically. I believe it's set up to do at least once daily check-ins to see if you have symptoms or any anything that could be related to the COVID vaccine. So that's more of like an active surveillance process, whereas VAERS is more what we call passive surveillance. So if you do have a symptom, then you log into VAERS and report it to CDC. So CDC is constantly collecting this data and releasing reports on any vaccine associated events. And I think that data will continue to come forward. So I think, you know, sort of the fundamental understanding of how the vaccines work, what was seen in the large phase three clinical trials is the first part, but also that robust monitoring system for safety events is the other key part.
We also got to speak with Emil Konen, a statistician at the UConn Health Disparities Institute, about the impact of health disparities on vaccine rollout in Connecticut. Here he is.
My name is Emil Konen, statistician with the Health Disparities Institute, which is part of UConn Health, which is part of UConn. I have a PhD in communication science, actually, from UConn, which I got some time ago, but I specialized in statistics since. So I got to learn a little more about attitudes, including attitudes about vaccination. But that's not what we're studying. We are generally studying equity disparities, health disparities in general. There is strong evidence that where we live is linked to our chances to be healthy. So it should be considered in this mix of decision points. Who gets vaccinated, who doesn't, first or second. And probably it will be.
Usually location, at least in Connecticut, determines your income, what kind of access to health you have, et cetera, et cetera.
It is. It's actually a strong factor. Actually, this is something that I've been doing. Dr. Kirsten Eck, she actually has a model, a teaching model that does exactly this, which is to teach students, medical students, about the not just the importance, the theoretical importance of living conditions, but she literally used to have a walk through. Students really can get to see people, neighborhoods, and the conditions, and try to make a more informed decision when they become doctors about actually what can they recommend to some of the residents in specific areas, and which in fact they should be visiting as doctors when they become doctors, because it's very simple to tell a patient you should be eating more healthy when in the neighborhood there is no grocery store with vegetables and healthy food, or there's only one, so or there's no pharmacy.
Thank you.
As states continue to navigate this really difficult vaccination rollout, college students are also a demographic that may not be the easiest to get on board with getting the vaccine. University Business reports that a mid-sized public university in Connecticut surveyed their students about how they were feeling about the vaccine, whether or not they would get it, whether or not they trusted it, and only half of students surveyed said that they would take the vaccine. Jonathan, I don't know about you, but I feel like that number should be higher.
Yeah, it'd be a little more reassuring if we knew that more of our friends wanted to get the vaccine.
Right? I know that I'll get the vaccine when I'm offered it. What about you?
I believe so. I truly do want to get out of this and back to my normal life.
And it seems like getting the vaccine and making sure our friends are getting the vaccine is the only way we're going to get there. Even though it might be a while before we're allowed to. But in that report from University Business, one of the main concerns from college students is the fear of the unknown, which I have fear of the unknown in basically every aspect of my life. And so that resonates with me a little bit. But at the same time, like we said, we need the vaccine to get out of this pandemic and to see our friends and to hug people in public again.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's like I ate Play-Doh as a kid. I really think I'm immune to any like biological stuff, you know?
There's a lot of memes that I've been seeing out there saying if you went to parties in a frat basement, you're immune to the vaccine. But at the end of the day, it's a meme. It's just for laughs. Everyone needs this vaccine.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that I feel like one of the only ways I think will help to get people educated about this vaccine is, you know, campaigns, social media campaigns. We're always on social media. I checked my phone usage the other day. I spend like 4 hours a day scrolling through social media. That's insane. And I'm not on there a lot. So I feel like social media campaigns, you know, making posts and stories, informing people about what the vaccine is, I feel like that'd be a pretty good way to get college students on board. What do you think?
I think that'd be a great idea. In fact, I saw companies like Instagram and Twitter, you know, how they like block out posts, or they'll say under the post, like independent fact checker.
Yeah.
Independent fact checkers have verified this. And it's
classified.
You know, like, I think that could be pretty useful.
I've definitely seen on pretty much any post on Instagram that has to do with COVID-19, there's a little link and it says, for more information about COVID-19, visit cdc.com or whatever the handle is. And so I think that's definitely useful for people like us who primarily get our information from the internet.
Yeah.
And even though students aren't on campus in as much of a capacity as they were in past years, I think flyers could definitely be helpful too. You know, there are people who are still trying to get in-person classes and study in libraries, and so flyers there might be helpful, or even like clubs trying to promote safety and vaccines. You know, we have I think over 500 clubs at UConn, and I don't know how many of them are actually active, but I think clubs promoting the vaccine would be really helpful.
Yeah, I think there's like over 740 or something. I know because I go there a lot. I like to broaden my interests. Yeah.
So one thing that's still being investigated though, which I'm actually really curious about, is whether or not schools can require the vaccine. And I don't think there's been a decision made on that yet, but it'd be really interesting to see if colleges and universities tried to, when people have mass access to this vaccine, make sure that college students get it before returning. What do you think?
Well, it's like, you know, you go to your My Health portal, you go to your UConn Health portal, and you see required immunizations like influenza, meningitis, measles, stuff like that. So honestly, I don't see any reason for why they couldn't say, hey, you can't come back onto campus unless you get the COVID vaccine. And I know there's been a lot of historical precedent for, it was like this case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. Like, I think compulsory vaccination laws are totally like possible.
Mm-hmm. And obviously they are possible. I don't know, Kate, like, what's your opinion on, like, mandatory vaccines?
I think there's definitely those exemptions for religious or health reasons that I guess I could kind of understand maybe sometimes. But for something like this, where we know it's safe for so much of the population and it's the only way we're going to get out of this, I think I'd be behind that as long as it's, you know, legal. But of course, I'm no law expert, so something that has to be explored.
We will get to it in time. According to a website called TrackTheRecovery.org, 1 in 3 small businesses have closed in Connecticut. As of December 31st, small business revenue in Connecticut has decreased by 37.6% since January of 2020. And in the leisure and hospitality business alone, revenue decreased by nearly 70% since last January. Especially because of, you know, all the travel bans and mandatory quarantining that, you know, like if I go to Vermont, I'm going to have to quarantine for 14 days and come back. It's, yeah. Like a vacation isn't really worth it.
Exactly.
And as of December 31st, the number of small businesses open in Connecticut have decreased by 36.4% since January 2020. Out of curiosity, did you have any travel plans, Kate, when this whole thing went down?
Let me think. I don't believe I had any travel plans, but I do have a friend who last March had made, even before last March, had made plans to go to Disney World with her friends on spring break, and she was absolutely beside herself when all that was canceled. And I mean, she made the right decision. It was so unclear how things were going at that point. And I can't say that I'll be traveling anytime soon. What about you? I know, you know, going back and forth between Connecticut and California, where you're from, that can be hard.
Yeah, I saw my family in Cali over winter break, when like hospitals are running out of ventilators and oxygen. Wow. Like, imagine running out of oxygen. That's like something that's pretty unheard of, at least in my experience. But yeah, I don't know. I was gonna travel to Italy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But what can you do, right?
Yeah,
so I think it's for the greater good. But yeah. Yeah, back to the point is a lot of small businesses in Connecticut have closed.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that a lot of families and a lot of just a lot of people are struggling, because if the small businesses are closed, that means that places where I can get stuff from and every other family in Connecticut can get stuff from, especially those in impoverished areas, mm-hmm. that those, because they've closed, it's just a lot harder to go get your stuff now. And then the people who are profiting in the small businesses, the small business owners, are kind of left flailing out in the void, you know. And so it really is tragic, but of course there has to be action taken, and there has been action taken. And you kind of have to ask, okay, what can the small business owners do, what can the community do, and what can the state do, and then furthermore, what can the national government do? So we'll start with the state. In December 2020, Governor Ned Lamont allocated $325 million to help small businesses. He said that the final pool of businesses would be 1,500 to 2,000 stores, and grants to those businesses would be about 10 to 30 grand. In addition to this, the Trump administration lent another $285 billion in December to the CARES Act. This was the act that they signed back in March,
where
all of us are all too familiar with, for small business relief.
Mm-hmm.
And then locally, there are many organizations teaming up with their communities to better serve small businesses during the pandemic. One example is a Mansfield Downtown Partnership. The town of Mansfield, where I'm residing right now, has has partnered with the University of Connecticut to offer like guides and connections between the public domain, so like mm-hmm. the government, and the private domain, the small businesses. Mm-hmm. And what the small businesses can do is kind of reach out and be like, you know, they can apply for loans from mm-hmm. the CARES Act, they can apply for loans to this little to the Ned Lamont relief,
mm-hmm.
and they can also
and they can also reach out to their friends and families. You know, GoFundMe has actually been a, and Kickstarter, unfortunately slash fortunately, mm-hmm. has yeah. been a good supporter, like crowdfunding small businesses and keeping them afloat. Kate, have you witnessed any, out of curiosity, have you witnessed any maybe like community or like individual collaborations, like where people might help with small businesses or like?
I do have a story about that. And unfortunately, it's not in Connecticut. Well, maybe fortunately, it's not in Connecticut. But so I eat gluten-free, and there's this completely gluten-free restaurant in New York City, and it's called Senza Gluten. And they are incredible. I went there once. It was the best experience of my life. And earlier on in the pandemic, they announced on Instagram that they were going to be shutting down because not enough people were going out. Of course, New York City, one of the hardest hit areas by the pandemic, they just didn't have enough money to stay afloat. And it spread like wildfire through social media. Everybody was flocking to their website to buy up goods that they ship. People were going and ordering food from them at, like, in person. It was incredible. And days later, they come back on Instagram and announce that they now have enough money to stay open. And since then, they've been doing so well. And so that overwhelming support from the community, awesome. It was crazy to see that firsthand happen and unfold. And I'm pretty excited because that's the first place I'm going when all this is said and done.
Great.
So speaking of small businesses, I actually had the opportunity to speak with Matthew Puglisi from the Connecticut Small Business Development Center. And he and I talked about Connecticut's response to this crisis that small businesses are in due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So can you talk to me a little bit about what kind of services you guys have been providing during the pandemic for businesses who are suffering hardships due to COVID-19?
Yeah, sure thing. So Connecticut Small Business Development Center, you know, it's been very busy for the last 10 months during the pandemic. But I think in terms of what we've been doing, it's helpful to also say what we've been doing normally. So we exist as part of a national program, the Small Business Development Centers, and they are funded through federal money through the Small Business Administration. So we receive part of our program funding from the SBA, and then part of it from the Connecticut Department of Economic and Community Development. And nationally, all of the programs are housed within state universities. So we're really proud to be hosted by UConn, and we're embedded in the School of Business, and the School of Business is a great partner. And so what we do is we provide small businesses, so that's up to 500 employees and up to approximately $19 million revenue is what the definition is of a small business. We provide them with all sorts of guidance and counseling and business problems that they're encountering. So whether that is a startup that is looking to figure out how do they register and how do they start to set up a budget for the first time, or if it is a business that has been in operation for 30 years and they're looking to grow, or they're looking to acquire financing to take on, you know, an update to technology for their, you know, systems. Mm-hmm. It's a whole range. So it's, we kind of like advise in kind of four main buckets, access to capital for businesses. So we're helping them get the loans or the private equity money that they need to grow. We are helping them start if they're looking to start for the first time. We do a lot in terms of customer acquisition. So marketing, export, trade, SEO, digital media, providing that type of guidance. And then also operational. So looking to change the kind of operations and processes and the internal, you know, workings of the business, cybersecurity, payment and inventory processes. So a whole range of service that we provide. And right now we have 20 advisors that are doing that. To get back to your original question though, during the pandemic and the shutdown, right away, the Connecticut Small Business Development Center was working with DECD to help get the attestations that the state needed to show that we were experiencing a disaster. And so we were helping businesses fill out the paperwork that the state needed to say, this is how our revenue's been affected. This is what's happening. We're experiencing a financial crisis. And that was really critical because Connecticut needed to get that disaster declaration so we could start to access the emergency funding before Congress had passed the CARES Act. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the first pieces. Since then, our advisors have been literally working around the clock trying to help small businesses understand the ways that they could access the emergency funding that Congress has made available mm-hmm. and the different relief programs. So whether that was navigating decisions of should I lay my employees off right now so that they could access unemployment, or should I take advantage of this paycheck protection program, but that means I have to keep them on the payroll. What does that mean for us? So we would help people understand the programs, help people understand, you know, the different risk reward for their particular business and scenario. And then we also have helped people, the state of Connecticut had its own, you know, emergency funding programs, and we helped people provide for that, you know, apply for that, the Connecticut Bridge Loan Program in the spring of 2020. And then this fall, most recently, was the Connecticut CARES grant, which was a $5,000 grant for small businesses.
Gotcha.
So a lot of this disaster loan relief kind of work. And at the same time, we've had businesses that are starting for the first time. Lots of people lost their jobs and they looked at the environment and said they need to start their business that they've been thinking about starting out of necessity or out of opportunity.
So we've seen in the last couple of weeks since the vaccine has started to begin distribution that Connecticut is kind of a leader in the country as far as the vaccine distribution is going, which is great. So how do you think the increased number of vaccinated people in the coming weeks, the coming months, will impact small businesses? And is it safe to assume that small businesses might start to see a light at the end of this tunnel because of the vaccine?
I think it's a hard question for me to really give an answer that's really anything more than my opinion or speculation. You know, I happen in my own community to be part of our town's emergency management, you know, mm-hmm. team that's kind of been paying attention to how things happen on the ground level. And it's going to take time to get everybody vaccinated up into a place that we really have the protections that we have. And so I think that one thing, while we all feel, I think I can unequivocally say with the development of the vaccines has provided everybody with a sense of hope as we've entered 2021. And that's great. And we hope that it's a light at the end of the tunnel. I think what everybody needs to do is I don't know what the right the right period of time is, but we have to stay vigilant. We have to be patient, and we have to continue to practice, you know, the health safety precautions we've been taking as businesses and as consumers for the next several months, because the vaccine's getting rolled out and Connecticut is a leader, but at the same time, it's still such a small proportion of the population that's been vaccinated. So it's not like next week, all of a sudden we can go back to full capacity. And so we all have to remember to keep our masks on, stay distanced, wash our hands. And at the same time, you know, order takeout from your favorite restaurant and buy online from your Main Street hardware store instead of ordering from Amazon.
Of course. So in your opinion, because, you know, obviously this is just how you think of it, how has Connecticut's government handled this distribution of relief of these resources to small businesses? So like you were talking about the program back in spring 2020, the CARES grant for this fall, has it been enough? And do you think there's more that Connecticut could do?
So we've had the opportunity to work closely with the Department of Economic and Community Development, with the Connecticut Office of the SBA, and a lot of other support organizations throughout the state. And I also know the town economic development directors and elected officials, our chambers of commerce have all been working very, very hard to help support the businesses, help to try to get things out as quick as possible. You know, it's been an unprecedented event economically for businesses and also for government to manage. And I think that, you know, while everybody has probably done things in an order sometimes they wish that they didn't. I think that the state's done a really good job trying to support and navigate a crisis that was really changing on a, you know, weekly basis, the information that we had. You know, I hope, you know, we all hope, I think, that there could be more relief available to the small businesses that are out there. We hear that from businesses regularly. But, you know, relief alone isn't going to fix it. I think there needs to be a combination of what the government can do to provide a level of support and the adjustments that we can all learn to put into practice to operate a little bit more efficiently, and to make the changes, you know, based on the environment.
So before we move on, I want to touch on that really quickly, those changes in operation that many, many businesses have had to make due to the pandemic. Can you maybe talk about some of them? And are these things that we might see permanently change because of the pandemic? You know, a horrible thing to happen and to have had to make these changes for, but is it something that businesses might use going forward?
I think that, I think it's our advice that businesses take a look and look exactly for the opportunity here. You know, the glass is half full and half empty, and you have to look and learn from everything. So, you know, for example, we've all talked about like going totally paperless, and all of a sudden we all kind of had to go totally paperless really quickly. We were all working, you know, from home on laptops or devices. We weren't in our offices. We weren't using printers in the same way. Everything's being traded electronically then. That changed things completely. I know for our own organization, our advisors loved sitting down face to face with a client and meeting with them, you know, in their office or at the place of business. And all of a sudden, we've needed to meet with them virtually on Zoom calls or by phone all the time. Mm-hmm. And we've changed the way that we advise. And at the same time, we've also become more efficient. We've been able to help more people in this mm-hmm. way. And so there's cost efficiencies within our own budget. And I think every business can find that and find the opportunity to take the benefits that they've seen over these last 9 months mm-hmm. and figure out how do we put this into practice on a regular basis, even if everything opened back up 100% tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Pivot happens in business all the time, you know, and there is a restaurant near me that is on its third pivot since COVID happened. You know, when they first shut down, they went to doing, instead of this great menu that they had, they went to doing only one or two meals for takeout. So they really said, this is the one fancy meal that we're making tonight, you know, take it or leave it. And that did really well. Well, they were really creative kind of meals. 3 months later, they shifted and all of a sudden they were doing prepared foods. And they took all of their popular meals and they turned them into prepared foods. They cleared out the restaurant from tables and they brought in refrigerators. And so all of a sudden it was a prepared foods like market. Mm-hmm. Most recently this fall, they now have 5 other restaurants that are working under their roof that are all doing this shared prepared foods model mm-hmm. for takeout and pickup. And so they've kind of become a ghost kitchen, but they've maintained their brick and mortar location and been able to maintain their customer base. And, you know, so it's that type of adaptation that we need to have. You know, some places operate in a really nimble way. Manufacturing, we have several clients that, you know, moved into the area of manufacturing PPE in the spring when there was a real need for hand sanitizer, for face shields, for other types of protective equipment. And you saw a lot of businesses making that type of shift. You know, can we make cloth masks? Can we start selling things that, you know, there's a demand for? Those are adjustments that businesses need to make, and you need to be nimble enough to be able to make. And I think that lesson in terms of how prepared you need to be and how quickly you need to be able to react to the consumer environment are really good lessons for people to have as takeaways. Thanks for reaching out to us.
Absolutely. And thank you, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
One business that really suffered because of the pandemic and is really close to our hearts here at UConn is Lizzie's Curbside and Catering. Lizzie went almost completely out of business early on in the pandemic, and now she's celebrating 30 years with the UConn community. She's been a staple at UConn, feeding students in between classes from her food truck, And now, because of some really gracious community members, she's located at the Nathan Hale Farm and Feed. Now Lizzie is trying to build her business back up. Listen to her story here. Can you tell me a little bit about how your business has been doing in comparison to how it was doing before the pandemic to how it's been doing since March when the pandemic really started to hit Connecticut hard?
Well, the pandemic put me out of business completely. So as you know, I've been up at UConn. This February 1st will be my 30th anniversary on campus. Mm-hmm. And as of March 15th, when the university closed, that closed me down because 90% of my business is UConn. And the other business, I do have a full catering company. And going into the spring months, which I had a very large amount of events up at UConn with graduation, a lot of events for that, very large events, up to 800 people for the graduating seniors. Those, all of that was canceled. Regarding my catering business, car shows were canceled. The Coventry Farmers Market was canceled. All weddings were postponed and or canceled. So all of my summer business, when usually I'm slower at UConn, I pick up with weddings and such, and there was none. So I was dead in the water, like most people in the restaurant business, and was completely beside myself.
Yeah.
Because I lost my employee. Mm-hmm. I just basically, lost everything, and it was just a horrible, horrible experience. And it's not that much better now. I did have the opportunity in September or maybe July, August, September, maybe late July, I was interviewed by NBC Connecticut, and I was on camera, and it was a very emotional interview for me and for everybody that knew me that watched it, even people that don't know me that watched it. It was very emotional because I ended up breaking down on camera. Mm-hmm. And that was rough. So there's a couple that started a farm stand and feed store in Coventry on Route 44. It's called Nathan Hale Farm and Feed. And they saw the story and they got in touch with me and asked me if I would be willing to set my trailer up at their new stand, which used to be the old Muldoon's stand on Route 44. Mm-hmm. And they took it over, and it's on its way out to going to Hartford. So it was a great location. Mm-hmm. And I was doing nothing. So I said, you know what, why not? It's not what I expected to do to rebuild myself at this stage of the game. But I had to start doing something to pay the bills. So that's where I am right now. It's a lot different than UConn. It's not a captive audience like UConn, but it is something that I'm trying to build, but it's going to take, some time, especially starting at, now it's in the wintertime, and my numbers are a lot different than my numbers at UConn, but, I've got to start somewhere until the pandemic gets, under control and I can get back to my family at UConn.
Yeah. Wow. What a roller coaster it's been for you. And to have that opportunity to be at the stand that you are now, that's awesome. That's incredible.
It's something. It's something.
Of course. And, like you said, it's not UConn, but I'm glad that you were able to find somewhere. That's really great.
Yeah, and everybody's been really supportive, and people actually, a lot of my regulars, they drive from UConn, mm-hmm. to the stand, or on their way to UConn from like the Hartford area or, Manchester area, they know I'm there now and they stop. And there's, a lot of trucker peoples and, construction people and stuff like that. And we're building, a new clientele. you know, everybody's trying to do the best they can and stay safe. And, you know, my heart goes out to the actual restaurants. At least food trucks have a chance because we're open air.
Yeah.
And we can still, you know, a lot of food trucks can still operate where restaurants cannot.
Yeah, that is true. So what was it like emotionally for you the fall semester where you couldn't be on campus where you were for 29 years at that point?
Yes. Emotionally, it was terrible. I'm a very, very upbeat person, a very positive person, a very happy, you know, go lucky woman. And I found myself depressed.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a slump. You know, you just don't want to do anything. I was on edge. I just felt hopeless and helpless because I just didn't know, and I still don't know what the future is going to bring. You know, I had a very successful business that completely crashed. And I found myself just really angry, pissed off, you know, all of the negative emotions that you feel in this type of situation. And I've bounced back as far as being that happy-go-lucky person, you know, but I still, you know, there's the little monkey on my shoulder saying, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? So I'm trying to be positive and trying to get, you know, all my positivity back, but that's going to take some time. I don't think I'm going to be back to normal until we are all back to normal and I'm back at UConn.
And I know that's the sentiment of you and so many students and faculty out there that just need that normalcy and need to be back.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When given the opportunity, have you or will you get the vaccine?
Yes. Yeah. You know, there was at one point I was sort of like on the fence, you know, would I get it? Oh, I don't know. And then, you know, and then I'm like, yes. I mean, I don't get the flu vaccine. I never have. Maybe because I have a phobia of needles, but I would definitely get this vaccine. And so would my husband. And, you know, I can't run a business not being vaccinated and dealing with the public.
Yeah.
You know, I'm putting people at risk if I'm not vaccinated.
Yeah. That's something a lot of small business owners are really going to have to wrap their heads around, because at that point, it's not really your own personal choice. You have to do it to run your business.
That's correct. You know, and you're going to probably have to put a sign up that you are vaccinated.
Yeah.
I mean, I put a sign up in my window at the Wagon that, you know, COVID negative, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Do you think, has that been reassuring for people? Have you seen a positive impact of that sign?
Not really. People don't really comment.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have the sign up, you know, wear a mask.
Yeah.
And there are people, I'm also covered in plexiglass. So it's not, I'm not open, you know, where you can come up and, you know, grab a sandwich. You talk through plexiglass and I open the plexiglass and hand it out to you.
I want to move on a little bit to Connecticut's response to small businesses struggling during the pandemic. What do you think they did well? What do you think they could have done better? And was any of it helpful for you? Because like you said, you were pretty much out of business for a really long time.
You know, I'm not a political person. I think that the Governor Lamont did the best he could, by being thrown into this situation, just like everybody else that is in power. I think that you know, getting a stimulus check and getting a small business loan was definitely helpful. But I really, it's hard for me to answer that question because I'm not a political person.
That's
right. I think that everybody is doing the best they can. I think that a lot of small businesses don't think that he did the right thing, especially with, you know, phase one, phase two, you know, of, you know, closing down restaurants, you know, having limited space. You know, is it the right thing to do? I think it's the safest thing to do, but that is you know, crushing small businesses, especially restaurants. Thank you so much. Stay safe.
Absolutely. You too, Lizzie. Bye.
Bye-bye.
However, not all businesses suffered economically as a result of the COVID pandemic. A prime example is the general store GM Thompson & Sons up in Eastern Connecticut. With increased foot traffic and curbside pickups, they have been thriving and operating normally since last March. All right, so for those of us who don't know you, can you please introduce yourself?
I'm George Thompson, and I am the third.
Today we'll be talking about how your business has been doing during the pandemic, any financial aid you've had, et cetera. So, all right, so the first question is, how exactly has the COVID pandemic impacted your business operations?
Well, we've been pretty good, pretty lucky up until this past week. We've had no COVID with our employees until last Monday. So we're all right, we've been all right.
Did one of your employees get exposed?
Actually, four of them.
Oh,
out of 11.
Yeah. Oh my God. So you guys have been kind of operating on, you guys have been kind of operating did you reduce business hours, or can you still operate the business easily?
No, we did not. People. We're still operating. A couple of the employees work longer hours than they normally do. But yeah, we're making it work. It's only temporary. We're making it work.
In terms of financials, I don't know how much you can talk about it, but because the pandemic has pretty much reduced business everywhere, have you seen a significant decrease in consumer spending, but just people coming in, people buying stuff?
John, just the opposite. Since last March, our business and our foot traffic has increased.
Oh, seriously?
Do a lot of curbside pickups. Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah. A lot of people stayed home. You know, a lot of people stayed home last spring and summer and did garden work and lawn and garden work, had their own vegetables, got some chickens and some other livestock like that. So people had the time at home to do that stuff, and they took advantage of it.
That's actually great. Like that honestly, not an answer that I wasn't expect the unexpected, right? But that wasn't an answer that I was expecting.
Right.
So people just had a lot more time at home to cultivate gardens, play with their kids, try new
things. Exactly. Yeah.
And they came to your business to do so.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
The worst part of the downfall of that on our end was be able to get supplies and stuff in, because all the vendors had the COVID. They dealt with COVID as well. And it's just this domino effect getting stuff in.
Did supplies become more expensive, or did they just become more limited, or both?
The price hasn't changed, really. It's just a limited availability of stuff.
Yeah.
Because of the high demand.
Yeah, because I was thinking when there is limited availability, usually prices shoot up, right? Lows, right?
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
I mean, it's all good to hear. It's actually nice to hear that you're doing so well, or better than you were.
Better than we thought we would be. Yes.
Yeah. I guess in terms of business operations, do you think the vaccine is going to have any effect on your business operations, or most likely not, because your business has been flourishing, not dying?
I don't think it's going to have an effect. I think if any effect, it's going to have a negative effect, because of the vaccine will give you a false sense of security.
Yeah.
I mean, with your first shot, you think you're all set. You don't take precautions as much as you think. And second shot, then you get to wait a week or so after that before the antibodies start to grow. That would be the only downside, I would think.
Yeah. And I actually wanted to ask, because I know Governor Lamont was,
He just released a plan or a relief plan to give grants to small businesses. And then I know at the start of the pandemic, around April or so, that, you know, Congress passed like this loan program for small businesses. Mm-hmm. Did you ever take advantage of that, or you didn't really need to?
We didn't need to at the time. We left it in there to allow the businesses that needed it to have it there for them. We didn't want to take away from them. Mm-hmm.
And then, so in general, are you friends with a lot of other like business owners?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Have you, for those who haven't done well, do you think that Connecticut has generally done a good job at supporting them, at supporting the dying businesses around you, or not really?
Oh boy.
You can go ahead.
I think it's fair. I mean, they could do so much more with the payment protection program. And what the state came up with, they could have limited number of employees for the minimums to get these loans. I don't think the big companies needed it. This is a small one. A lot of the restaurants, they need some help, really do.
And in terms of that, did you see any community efforts to support these small businesses, like fundraisers maybe, or like little efforts to like help out, or everybody was just kind of like, you're on your own now?
I think there was more community effort to support community families that needed the help, not really as much as the business as part of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any like specific efforts, or not really? Like any that stood out to you? I don't know.
Yeah, there was one group, or actually individual, a teacher in Mansfield who spearheaded gathering groceries and needs for families, and had a fundraiser, a GoFundMe page that really did a lot of work, and it really benefited a lot of different families in town.
Yeah.
But go support your local business.
Yeah, I promise I will.
All right, sir.
Have a good one.
Take care of yourself.
Bye. You too. Bye.
Today, we've steered you through vaccine distribution, vaccine composition, and how the pandemic has impacted small businesses in Connecticut. Thank you all for tuning in, and thanks again to all of the wonderful guests that we had on our show today.
This podcast would have not been possible without them. And so, without further ado, we've been your hosts, Jonathan Kapeliovich
and Kate Ariano.
And you're listening to News on Overdrive on WHUS Stores.
That just about sums up the show that we have for you all today. I guess that's all I'm saying.
Well, okay, let's try it again. We could add in bloopers if you want, like not as like a separate episode.
I think that'd be fun to add bloopers into every end of the show. Yeah, I'm gonna do that. Just give me a second to think.
Nice nails.
Oh, thank you.
Purple?
No, they're like maroon, like a mauve, I think.
Mauve,
kind of.
Never heard of it.
I don't know. It's like a purpley red brown.
My color theory is not up to par.
Yay!
You like that ending?
Yeah, that was perfect.